in the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Great American Insurance Company versus North Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1 from Travis County. Travelers Indemnity Company of Illinois and Travelers Insurance Company versus Regina Fuller from Jefferson County. Syntec Realty, Inc. versus Karen Seeley from Harris County. And Abbott Laboratories, Inc. and others versus Crystal Segura and others from Travis County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument, except for the final cause where we have allotted 25 minutes for each side. The petitioner may reserve a portion of this time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, which will conclude the arguments before our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Great American versus North Austin Mud.
May it please the court, Mr. Arthur Salander is present to present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Arthur Salander. I am with the Dallas law firm of Quilling, Salander, Comiskey, Klutz, and Lowndes. We represent the petitioner in this cause, Great American Insurance Company. Briefly, this case arose out of a construction project in the northern portions of Travis County. The construction project was a wastewater lift station. It was a public project that was governed by the McGregor Act and required bonding. The owner of the project was the respondent in this case, North Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1. The general contractor was Underground Utilities Incorporated. The manufacturer of the lift station, which is in question, was Smith Pump Company. And the McGregor Act surety in this case was your petitioner, Great American Insurance Company. After the construction project was finished, a structural deformity, a 3-inch bulge structural deformity was noted in the wastewater in the wastewater lift station shell. A dispute arose between the owner, the general contractor, and the manufacturer of the lift station, both as to the cause of the deformation as well as the issue of the contractual responsibility of either Smith Pump or Great American's bond principal, Underground Utilities, to repair that. During the course of the discussion about that issue, the surety was involved. The surety contacted both the obligee and the bond principal to determine what their position was in the dispute. It ascertained that there was a genuine dispute about the issues of causation and liability and was engaging in a discourse with the obligee regarding that issue, which the obligee terminated and filed suit. The trial court rendered judgment against Great American under Article 2121, Section 16 of the Insurance Code. The trial court also submitted the case to the jury alternatively under the common law duty of good faith and fair dealing. There was affirmative findings of the jury on that issue. The Austin Court of Appeals affirmed the action of the trial court in all respects, and this appeal ensued. The questions before this court are as follows. Whether a bond obligee can assert a cause of action against a commercial surety under Article 2121, Section 16 of the Texas Insurance Code. Great American's position in response to that question is no. Great American reaches that conclusion by a construction of Article 2121 itself, which demonstrates on its face that it does not embrace commercial suretyship. The second question before the court is whether or not the provisions of Article 1.14-1 of the Texas Insurance Code, which is essentially a jurisdictional statute and the definitions contained therein, can be engrafted upon Article 2121 to make it apply to a commercial surety when on its face it does not. Great American's position that the answer to that question is no, again for the simple reason that a plain reading of Article 2121 demonstrates There was no legislative intent to include those definitions in it. A subsidiary issue to that is if this court were to find that Article 2121 applies to a commercial surety, then should it be applied prior to the time that there has been an adjudication of the principal's liability to the obligee? Great American says that the answer to that question is that the application of 2121 should not be made until there has been an adjudication of its principal's liability, for the simple reason that the bond obligee does not have a claim against the surety until such time as the liability of its principal has been established. The surety's liability is simply derivative and secondary and contingent upon its bond principal's liability. Not finally, but the next issue of the court is whether or not a common law duty of good faith and fair dealing should be implied in the commercial suretyship relationship. The answer to that question is no, and again, for the simple reason that the commercial suretyship relationship is not one that is analogical to the special relationship that you find in the insurance context. The suretyship relationship are generally involve commercial transactions which are negotiated at arm's length between sophisticated parties. There is not an imbalance of bargaining power either in the negotiation of the contract or in the handling of the bond claim. There is no special relationship in the commercial suretyship context that requires the imposition of a duty of good faith and fair dealing. Finally, the court is also decided that it wishes to hear argument on the issue of whether or not prejudgment interest should be trebled under Article 2121. Great American's position is that it should be not, and that that issue has essentially, or at least implicitly, or impliedly been answered by the court back in the Vail case, where the court held that prejudgment interest should not be added to on treble damages, and also in the Kavanaugh case, where this court held that at least in the punitive damages context, prejudgment interest does not run on the punitive damage part of the award. Going back to the first proposition, does Article 2121 apply to commercial suretyship? To answer that question, you simply look at the preamble to Article 2121, which states that it purports to regulate the, quote, business of insurance, end of quote. That term is not ambiguous and should be given its ordinary meaning. Insurance, ordinary meaning, is a two-party contract between insurer and insured, whereby the insurer agrees to indemnify the insured against fortuitous events. It is a business which is based on the pooling of risks and the law of averages.
Isn't that only one type of insurance?
Pardon me?
Indemnity insurance? Isn't that what you're describing?
Well, but the difference, Your Honor, is that in the surety context, you are not pooling risks. The risk always devolves back upon the principal. In other words, if the surety pays...
My only point was the description you were giving or definition of insurance sounded like it was a definition of a particular type of insurance rather than insurance generally. And my question was,
I think you could say that applies to things like health insurance where, you know, the fortuitous risk is one's health. It applies to property insurance where the fortuitous risk might be a hailstorm or some other act of God. Or in terms of other types of liability insurance. I believe that generally covers the broad range of what insurance is considered to be.
So 2121 only covers liability insurance?
It covers not just liability insurance, but all forms of insurance that are two-party contracts that indemnify against contingent or fortuitous events and that are based on the pooling of risk and the law of averages. Article 2121 itself makes no reference to commercial suretyship. It's not in the statute. And suretyship itself historically has never been considered to be, quote, insurance, end of quote. It's a three-party relationship. There are really three contracts involved. There's an underlying contract between the obligee and the principal, which in most cases is a construction contract, because these types of bonds arise in McGregor Act construction projects, in Miller Act construction projects, and are sometimes not required but generally utilized in private construction contracts. But you have the underlying contract, that's one contract between obligee and bond principal. You have the surety contract or the bond contract, which involves all three parties. And in addition to that, generally in the surety relationship, you have a third contract between surety and principal, whereby the principal agrees to indemnify and hold the surety harmless against all losses that it might incur. That does not smack of insurance. That smacks more of a commercial lending type of relationship, whereby the surety lends credit to the principal so that if the principal cannot complete the project, the surety can. Article 2121, Section 4 also speaks in language of insurance policies and insurance policy holders. It does not make reference to surety bonds, obligees, or bond principles. The language simply is not in the statute. So if you look at 2121 alone, suretyship is not included. The only way that you can get there is if you try to engraft the provisions of Article 1.141 on Article 2121, and you simply can't do that for two reasons, or for three reasons. 2121 does not incorporate those definitions expressly. Number two, 2121 was first enacted in 1951, some 16 years before Article 1.14-1 was enacted. Therefore, it's hard to conceive of the legislature intending the definitions in Article 1.14 to apply to Article 2121. In this regard, you have to remember that the insurance code is not an integrated uniform statute like the Uniform Commercial Code or the Bankruptcy Code, where you have definitions which are created and applied throughout the whole code. These are discrete acts which are grouped together for purposes of convenience. And there is simply no basis when you look at Article 1.14 or Article 2121 to conclude that the definitions of one are to apply to the other. Certainly if the legislature wanted them to do that, they would. Bottom line here is that the legislature intended to regulate suretyship under Article 2121. It would have done so, and it did not.
Isn't the converse also true? The legislature had intended to exclude surety covenant. It could have done so. And that's what the Court of Appeals seized on.
That's what the Court of Appeals seized on, but I will point out to the court that in the instances where the legislature has, in fact, wanted to regulate suretyship, they have done so in express terms, and they have used suretyship language, such as the statutes regarding venue on bonds and the statutes regarding the requirements of a suretyship of a surety company to obtain a certificate to do business in the state. They make it express when they want to include surety. With respect to the common law duty of good faith and fair dealing, and I'm running a little bit short on my time. Again, the special relationship does not exist in this case. The fundamental contract underlying the suretyship relationship is this arm's length business transaction that's been negotiated typically by an owner with its engineers on its side and by the contractor with its engineers on its side. That is a commercial transaction. That is not a commercial transaction. The surety doesn't have anything to do with the underlying contract in terms of drafting it or providing for its provisions. It accepts it as it is. The surety also, at least in McGregor Act or a Miller Act bond case, doesn't have any control over the bond form. It's prescribed by statute. The suretyship has no impact on the underlying contract, no impact on the bond form. Also, the surety in that relationship is perhaps one of the most vulnerable parties in that relationship, and the legislature has recognized that, because even though a surety is compensated, it is a favorite of the law. And for that reason, sureties have quite a few rights that other litigants probably don't have. One is to require the joinder of their bond principal in any litigation against them. And I believe my time has run out, so.
Are there any questions?
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
I plead the court. Mr. Scott J. will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Kidd and I represent the North Austin Municipal Utility District, which is a utility district providing water and wastewater service to some 1,900 plus homes and businesses in Travis and Williamson County. Basic issues as I see them before the court today are whether Article 2121, the insurance code, apply to an insurance company in the issuance of a bond. Second, whether the application of the common law duty of good faith and fair dealing applies to an insurance company in the issuance and processing of a bond claim. Whether, and sort of as a subset of that, whether there is evidence to support a verdict that the insurance company violated that duty of good faith and fair dealing in this case, and the proper standard of review of the no evidence attack.
The way you phrase the issue, that it might be important whether the surety is also in the business of indemnity insurance. Is that your position?
I think it's important as whether or not the insurer is in the business of insurance as defined by the insurance code.
Well, if there were a surety here who was only in the business of suretyship and not in the business of insurance, as the two can be distinguished, would that be significant to your position?
No, sir, it would not. Specifically, and the remaining issue that I will try to address is the treble and the prejudgment interest, whether or not his actual damage is subject to treble.
So to be clear, if this were the Great American Surety Company instead of the Great American Insurance Company, your arguments would be the same?
Certainly. That is basically, you begin with Article 1.14-1 of the insurance code. Article 1.14-1 defines the business of insurance in Texas. And subsection 2 specifically makes the business of insurance to include the issuing of a contract of guarantee or surety as a vocation and not as simply incidental to some other activity. So if you have Great American Surety Company and as its business it issues bonds, then it comes clearly within that definition because it is issuing bonds as a vocation.
But Article 2121 speaks of policies.
Certainly.
In terms of policy, misrepresentation of policy.
Certainly, but
how do we interpret that to include bonds? What in this statutory framework indicates?
Well, there are several ways to get there, I think, Your Honor. One is 2121 also incorporates 1746. And any violation of 1746 would constitute, would grant a right of recovery under Section 16 if someone is engaged in the business of insurance. If you have a surety company, again, let's just assume it's not an insurance company, someone who's just in the business of issuing bonds, who in fact violates some provision of 1746, then under Article 2121, because that person is engaged in the business of insurance, the person who is harmed thereby would have a cause of action for that violation under Article 2121. And that's part of the claim that we had here. We claim both violations of 2121 itself, rules and regulations under 2121, and violations of 1746 as incorporated under 2121. So it doesn't require necessarily you to determine that this bond is a policy. You simply have to determine if, whether or not, there were misrepresentations which were within the prohibitions of 1746. I think, you know, logic and the statutory language itself would dictate that 2121 apply.
To come back to this question again, even though Article 2121 does refer to Article to Section 17.46, and Section 17.46 has its own coverage, Article 2121 does seem to speak to things which occur that have no relationship to the surety business. Why doesn't that indicate that you don't ever get to the reference because it never applies in the first place?
Well, you have to first determine what is the business of insurance. And it is not limited by the particular language in 2121, which refers to policy from time to time. It does refer in the Section 16 to the business of insurance. And there's only, I think Mr. Sulander would agree, there's only one place either one of us found in the insurance code where that term was defined, and that's 1.14-1.
Would you agree that the insurance code is not an integrated statute?
I do agree. I disagree that Article 1.14-1 makes no reference to 2121, because it does have several specific references to Article 2121. One of those is in Section 3 of 1.14-1, specifically referencing Article 2121 for the definition of person. And also, and I think Section 3A about the commissioner having the authority to issue cease and desist orders to people not authorized in the business of insurance in Texas who are violating 2121. And perhaps even more significantly, Great American has argued that you have to look to federal law to determine what the business of insurance is for the purposes of Article 2121 because of the introductory language to Article 2121 as it existed at the time this case arose and was tried. And that was that this was adopted to comply with the intent of Congress in Public Law 7915, the McCarran-Ferguson Act. That was an act which essentially left regulation of insurance companies to the states. It had the effect of removing insurance companies from the antitrust laws, federal antitrust laws, when the states had passed legislation which regulated the insurance industry. So they say, well, then you have to look to how the federal courts have interpreted the McCarran-Ferguson Act to determine whether or not this is the business of insurance. Look at the purpose clause of Article 1.14-1. Article 1.14-1 says that it was being, what the legislature was doing was exercising its power to protect residents of this state and to define what constitutes doing an insurance business in this state, and also exercises its powers and privileges available to this state by virtue of Public Law 7915, the McCarran-Ferguson Act. So what they're telling us in Article 1.14-1 is that their intent is to do the same thing generally that they were doing in 2121, that their reach of regulation is the same. Likewise, simply because under the McCarran-Ferguson Act and an interpretation of the business of insurance might be narrower than is directed by Article 1.14-1, does not make a difference. Under federal law, you would be interpreting an exemption to the antitrust laws. Accordingly, as the cases hold, you would want to interpret that exception narrowly. The purpose of 2121 and 1.14-1 is to regulate insurance companies and protect the citizens of Texas from improper business practices in the business of insurance. When it's remedial in nature, you would therefore want to interpret that more broadly. So the introductory language to 2121 doesn't limit its reach as to what the business of insurance is for the purposes prohibiting false, misleading, deceptive acts or practices.
I want to ask you real quickly about the evidence that you rely on for the false or misleading or misrepresentations. Are you relying on Section 16, which incorporates the DTPA, or Section 4, or both?
Actually, both. Principally, Section 16, which incorporates the DTPA.
Are there any, is there any evidence of misrepresentations or actions or acts that you think fall within Section 4 of 2121?
I cannot identify where Great American, prior to the issuance of the bond, made any misrepresentations. I can point to the fact that at the time that the bond claimer owned, and Ms. Charlene Collins, who was the attorney representing the MUD, notified the bonding company of the claim. She made claim under the maintenance bond. The bonding company was under the impression they didn't have a maintenance bond. They didn't disclose this fact to her. In fact, it's evident in their memos that they thought they might be able to use this fact to their advantage that there wasn't one. They didn't discover that they in fact had a maintenance bond until the depositions of their representatives a couple of months before this case went to trial, when they were presented with a copy of it.
Let me ask you a question. Have you put a response to her question?
Yes.
Assuming that 2121, we buy your argument, 2121 does apply to commercial surety, how do you respond to the argument that it should not be applied until there's a finding of liability on the principal?
Well, first, there's no prohibition against proceeding against the principal and the surety in the same action. And in fact, that was done here. Both Underground Utilities and Great American were sued on the contracts.
But they're not obligated to you until there's a finding of liability.
Well, that can be true, okay, so far as the bond claim. But as the court has pointed out, there is both the claim on the contract and there is a suit for bad faith. The bad faith deals more with the reasonableness of the insurance company's actions in dealing with the claim.
If there's a bona fide dispute as to liability, where's your bad faith?
I submit that there is no bona fide dispute as to liability. And I will detail that for you. I think that first we have to look at, you know, whether there's a duty of good faith and fair dealing with regard to a bond. I will submit to you that the other states who have faced this, and we're talking about Montana, Arizona, California, and Alaska, have all held that there is. I don't think that there is any state which has held that a duty of good faith and fair dealing does not apply as to a commercial surety. The duty is...
The relationship does seem a little different, though. Your opposing counsel referred to the maxim that sureties are a favorite in the law. Insurers are not. There does seem to be some difference.
There may be some slight distinction, but I submit to you that the reasons in Arnold that the duty of good faith and fair dealing were applied are equally present here.
Mr. Kidd, let me ask you, in that regard, you say that Section 16 under Article 2121 applies and that the surety is like an insurance company and that sort of thing. What is the MUD? Is the MUD the insured? Is the MUD the third-party claimant? What position does the MUD play in the scheme of Section 16?
MUD is the first-party claimant because the bond is a direct contractual obligation from the surety to the obligee, and the MUD is specifically named therein.
The MUD went to, I thought you said they had no contact with the surety until after the bond was issued. Didn't the MUD require the contractor for the contractor to apply for, in your terms, insurance to assure that the contractor does what the contractor says they're going to do, payable to the person who would be harmed if the contractor didn't do what he did?
That is true. They obtain it, but in a very real sense, the obligee, the owner, the MUD, pays for that insurance.
Why isn't, in the insurance scheme of things, the contractor, the insurer, the surety, the insurance company, and the third-party individual, the obligee under the bond, the one who gets paid if they're harmed. Why isn't that the scheme if you think insurance is what applies here?
Basically, you're saying why is the mud different from Ms. Watson? Okay. Ms. Watson was not specifically named as a person, and they weren't specifically protecting the interests of Ms. Watson when that insurance was obtained. Specifically here, this was required by MUD to go insure the interests of the MUD and to obtain that insurance, and in fact, that's part of the cost of that project, which the MUD paid for. It was included in the bid. It was paid for by the MUD. They have a direct obligation to us that they do not have to Ms. Watson. Secondly, they don't have an obligation to defend the principal in that case. The differing obligations that the court seemed concerned about in the Watson case dealt more with the duties that were owed to Ms. Watson as opposed to the duties that were owed to their insurer, and that this would create a conflict between the two if you implied a duty of good faith and fair dealing on behalf of a third-party claimant. In this particular instance, we are not a third-party claimant because they do have a direct contractual undertaking to us, so naming us. And that was the purpose of obtaining that particular coverage.
But in this scheme of things, though, the obligation to pay is predicated upon the determination that the contractor did not complete the project according to its planned specifications, and the question then being the obligation until there's a determination that that had occurred, the obligation to pay doesn't arise.
Well, being in the business of insurance, they would have the obligation to determine in good faith whether or not there was a legitimate claim. They did absolutely nothing after they were notified of the claim to investigate it. Ms. Collins supplied them with all the information that they got. They didn't send anyone to investigate it. They hired no engineers to evaluate it. The MUD supplied them with the contract. They didn't get it from their principal, didn't request it from their principal. They claimed that, well, he complied with the plans and specifications. They didn't even obtain the plans. The only specifications which were obtained were sent by Ms. Collins to him. And she specifically pointed out the contractual provisions which required the contractor to correct this and supplied him with all the insurance company with all of the correspondence where he was declining to do so, and in fact where he said he was financially unable to do so. The principal himself, in correspondence to the pump company, referred to this as a structural failure of the dry well. The contract clearly required the contractor to provide a dry well with a wall thickness sufficient for the depth of barrier. Clearly, he had not done so. The contract also was unambiguous that they had a one-year correction period for any defective work, which would include anything which did not comply with those specifications. The contractor hired their own engineer to evaluate the cause of the structure failure. That engineer agreed with our engineer that it was because the wall thickness was not thick enough.
There was no question between relocating a dry well and building a new dry well. There was no contest among the parties about whether that part about the wall being sufficient for the depth applying only as to new construction as opposed to...
There is no contest. And that's part of what the proof that we offered that was specific to the issue of bad faith. There's one set of specifications, and it is unambiguous that whether it is going to be a brand new dry well or it's going to be a refurbishment of this dry well, it meets this set of specifications, and it must. The MUD didn't care how they went about complying with that so far as the wall thickness, the pump capacity, etc. But whether they did it with the refurbished one or did it with the brand new one, they had to comply with that one unambiguous set of specifications. And there's no dispute about that. If you'll look in the trial court pleadings, there's no pleading of ambiguity on anything. We offered proof, both by a lawyer and incidentally both of the people with the insurance company who were handling this case and evaluating it were lawyers, that the contract is unambiguous. You can't review it and arrive at any conclusion but that it was the contractor's obligation to provide a dry well which was of a sufficient wall thickness to withstand the lateral earth pressures for the depth of burial. Likewise, that it was unambiguous that within 1 year, if any part failed because it was not in compliance with the specifications, they had the obligation to repair it or replace it. They wanted to say, well, that's the warranty work, that's the pump company's problem. It clearly was not under that contract. It's unambiguous. They didn't even plead that it was ambiguous. We offered proof, both the evidence which came in and as to the notification and the explanations from Charlene Collins to Mr. Kilburn of every contractual provision which obligated their contractor to do this, and from the testimony of Mr. Perlmutter, who reviewed the contract and was given each one of the reasons. Pardon me, my time is up, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Would you respond to the argument that there was no dispute here what
yes.
the problem was? All in, even your own engineer agreed with their engineer that the problem was the wall thickness.
Okay. The first dispute in the spring of 1989, which is when this controversy evolved, was what was an issue of causation. On Mudside, they had an engineer who said that he believed that the thickness of the shell wall was two times too thin to sustain the lateral earth pressures. Smith Pump, the manufacturer of the original station, which was relocated at the Rattan Creek site, who was also an engineer, testified and took the position that that was not true. He stated that this particular shell had been buried at another site for 4 years at the same depth and experienced no structural problems. He also believed that in his opinion as an engineer, that it was not too thin. The engineer that was engaged by the principal reached the conclusion that...
I agree with their engineer.
Well, no. By a factor of two, did not agree with their engineer. The principal's engineer stated that the thickness of the sides of the steel shell were precisely adequate to bear the lateral earth pressures, but his complaint was that there was no safety factor built in. So there was an issue of causation, number one. Number two, there was an issue of the general contractor's responsibility for design errors, and that is the specific clause in question was in exhibit number 5 was article 6.12, which basically stated that the general contractor was not responsible for design negligence in terms of specifying the manner of construction. And the position of the principal, as well as the surety, is that arguably specifying the refurbishment of an existing cell was a means of construction. And that was that there might have been negligence in that regard. The third area of dispute related to who had primary responsibility for the warranty obligations relating to the design of the particular station and the specifications in Exhibit 5 of the contract specifically state, and I'm talking about beginning on pages 0044 of Exhibit Number 5, language to the effect that Smith Pump, the manufacturer, shall issue the guarantee, and especially as it with respect to design, and shall assume prime responsibility for the guarantee of the station and all its components. It also stated that on request of the owner, within the 1 year period after the project was accepted, that the manufacturer, Smith Pump, would replace any defective parts. So there was a dispute about that. And perhaps at the core of the dispute was the way, the very peculiar way in which this project evolved, and that was months before this contract was awarded to Underground. And months before Underground and the surety got involved, the city of Austin, the MUD and their representatives got together with Smith Pump and decided whether or not it was feasible to move this lift station, and all of the decisions were made about what to do with that prior to the time of Underground.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mayor. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.